Can you hear me in the back? Okay, this is very loud. Let's see. Testing. Okay, yeah, let's get started. So welcome to the sixth lecture of the XML course. And I very much dislike this echo. Let's see if the other one is any better. There must be a volume knob, but at least I don't know. Okay, new try. Can you hear me in the back? Yeah, so welcome and welcome to the sixth lecture of the XML course. And first things first, I wanted to do a bit of a recap what's been happening so far. First of all, this lecture will discuss two parts. Firstly, the physical structure of XML documents, which is a bit less spoken part of the XML specification, but it's equally as, well, not maybe equally as important as this logical structure, but it still has some major components of XML that you should be aware of, especially if you in some way work with XML in the future. I'll try to keep that part rather brief, and then we'll discuss the usage of XML in organizations. So some practical examples from the projects me and Philip have been working on, where we have been developing some different types of systems and software for, let's say, for educational purposes, but also in other areas. So a couple of examples from those. But initially, some recap of what we've heard so far. First things first, I think in previous year, I think what was one of the issues that people didn't really grasp is the what XML, what all of these building blocks are more or less for. So that XML is a meta language to create other languages. So this DTD and that we don't define like the names of the elements and so on in the XML specification allows you, I mean the developers, the communities to make these, define the syntax, define the grammar for a particular purpose, and that's why you are creating your own language based on XML, and XML itself is just a kind of the guideline for doing that, and it's a meta language. So if you remember that is a language to create other languages, derive languages from, you get quite far already. And these languages might be for multiple purposes, for storing content, for interchanging data between systems and software, and so on. And in this lecture, we'll discuss kind of these varieties of different purposes where XML is used for. But I think the most important thing to remember from XML is the well-formedness and validity rules. So because these are something that are for every single XML language that are derived out there, these well-formedness and validity rules are the same. So first of all, that the beginning and an end tag must be there, that the elements are properly nested, if you remember from the second or third lecture that we had. So if you have a child element that like starts before another element, it must also close there so that these are properly nested. So you might want to recap this every now and then. And the validity rules are for those XML documents that have a DTD, so a grammar like attached to it. And if the XML document complies to the DTD, then it's valid. But if it doesn't follow, it's not valid. And also, if you have used different types of like a Notepad or something else for these tasks, the term validity might mean different things in different contexts. But in the XML specification, validity means exactly this, that the XML document corresponds to the grammar and the syntax rules defined in the DTD or in schema or some other language. But in this course, we focus on the DTD specifically. Logical structure is the main component of XML, so that it consists of the DTD, the the elements and attributes and the declarations, the different types of elements and attributes there might be out there. And we have the DTD there to define the grammar. But more or less, as always, when using XML, you are actually applying some sort of XML languages in a particular context, in an area, in the real world, more or less. So then you are making use of these XML blocks, building blocks that are out there. And in this course, we have been mainly discussing this XSL so far, so that's giving an external presentation for your XML document. And I hope you have had some small victories in your assignments already, like that, of course, it gets a bit more tedious because you have to, all other types of languages now become involved when you are using XML in a particular area. And in this case, when we are trying to put something on a web browser, we have to also take into account what other languages like HTML and so on there are. So, but the XSL, as you might remember, it's just to create it from XML, from these building blocks, to allow people to transform the documents to multiple purposes, to web browser, to Excel format, or something else. And the within there, the this XSL, the XSL transformations is more or less the programming language for XML, which gets it a bit more complicated. But how has it been so far? I mean, have some of you already tried out the assignment? There's still a bit more than 1 week to do the fourth assignment. Have some of you already done that? If you can raise your hand. Okay, not many. Has it been... Has somebody found it very, very hard? Maybe you can raise your hand. Or is it still something like that you're leaving to, I don't know, next week. But don't do it too late, because, I mean, it's a task that usually takes a bit more time, because there are different languages you need to kind of take into account, a bit more components there that are, like, influence your whether it works or not. So don't leave it to the last minute. This is more or less my recommendation to you. But if you have some problems there, just let Tony and me know. One major part is this something like XML as a data interchange language, and there different types of languages come into play, like SOAP and the according VSDL, which is more or less a kind of a DTD for this data interchange language. And that will be mainly the discussion point for next lecture, when Ville Seppänen comes to discuss about XML as a data interchange language. And that's, I think, one of the most, let's say, also a quite simple thing where you apply XML, but still what it has allowed people to do or different systems to interact with, it's quite brilliant, actually. So I hope you get something really out of this. But similarly, this SOAP, VSDL, these are something also that have been created from the XML blocks, remembering that XML is only a meta language, so you use it to derive languages for particular purposes, no matter if it's about exchanging information between systems or if it's representing information to human beings. But the applications areas are quite wide. But some of the examples during this lecture. But yeah, now I go to the second type of structure of XML, which is called the physical structure. So logical structure, as you might remember, is formed by these element and attributes that kind of form the tree structure. But this physical structure is something like where we can use, apply images, videos, bundles of text into our XML documents. You sometimes see this in differing areas. But this, when we do this, we are applying something that is called the entities. And entities and elements are not at all the same thing. Entities are something like bigger constructs that we can create. But I'll give some examples in a short while. But the physical structure it has some problems into it as well. But there are a couple of tricks that you might use it to... for example, support complex writing and multi-use, like that you don't have to always declare something again and again, but you can just declare something as an entity, some bigger block of DTD or something, and use it somewhere else. And that's something that physical structure allows you to do. But again, This won't be as big part of the course because there are also some problems related to it, but at least when you come across some code or XML in the future, you at least know what these entities are and how you might make use of them. But still, remember I'm not saying that in the exam we would be asking this in any way, but try to remember that entities and elements, they are not the same thing. Are not the same thing. Good. Okay. Commonly, this entity is something like a named piece of text. So, for example, an entity could be this abbreviation JYU, and then we have the value. Whatever goes inside these brackets could be an entity. And once we declare that, we can reference that very easily in the XML documents by just referring to the entity name. And altogether, this is a very simple example, but the purpose is just to avoid repetitive writing or complex pieces of text. If we have declared something sometimes, we can very easily reuse it. So firstly, entity is something like a container for something. There are different types of entity types. This doesn't tell much, but in the next slides I'll try to make some kind of a sense out of these. First of all, there are something called parsed and unparsed entities. And parsed entities are more or less just marked up text. So just text that the parser knows how to interpret. So if we have something like in the previous, something like universal or fivascular, that's something like that the parser can deal with. That the knows, okay, I need to just process this and put it forward. But there can be also something called unparsed entities that might be images, video files, and something else that you might include in your XML documents. And this is the area where which many developers say that has been kind of the very, very bad mistake around XML in general, that it's not a very good way to integrate interactive content to your XML files through these entities, because you might do that in your XSL document in otherwise as well. But okay, if we remember this just as the first point, parsed is something like text that we can interpret. Unparsed is something that might be videos, images, whatsoever, that we kind of just take up and like that the parser or the XML processor just takes away and puts it to forward. It doesn't try to even interpret it because it's usually some kind of a content that is not meant for the parser to understand. Internal and external entities are something like how the value is given. So internal entities that when we declare some like this piece of text, we give the name and value directly. If it's external, similar to DT, like this external DTDs, we get the value or whatsoever from another file, from elsewhere. So internal and external, this is just the differentiation. The third part is that where we are using these entities. Are we using them in the XML document itself? Of course, we have to declare them in DTD, which is kind of the grammar and syntax for our documents. But the thing is that is it something to support complex writing or whatsoever in the XML document, or is it just to make DTD writing easier? So this is kind of the differentiation between the general and the parameter entities. So general entities are to be used in the XML document, and they are declared in a different way. And the parameter entity is only used in the DTD. And now we come to some examples that hopefully make them a bit easier to understand. So first of all, we have something like parsed internal parameter entities. It sounds much more complicated than it is, but it just means that it's something like that the parser can understand. So it can be like element, some parsed character data, and it's something that we used internally in our DTD, and the value is given directly when we declare it, and it's to be used in the DTD itself. I can show this directly in the editor, how this could be. First of all, if we would have this type of, this DTD and according document, so there's something like a document that contains information about an employee when someone has been hired and how long, in which project this person is working in. We have very typical type of structure here, like elements. As you remember, we have to always introduce each element in our DTD separately. But we also can incorporate something like entities here, where we declare like bigger structures. For example, here you see declared an element project with its child elements. This is something that you actually might do. So we have an entity called project with its contents. And in the DTD, we reference it directly so that it more or less gives us this, what is inside the brackets. It's just a kind of a reference to replace this reference, this percent character and the project and the semicolon with this content that you see here. So it's more or less just to avoid repetitive writing. Or this might be also like much, much longer like declaration that it, like we are referencing an entity that includes maybe entire DTD or some parts of a DTD. It can be, for example, the DTD for the HTML language is consisting of multiple big DTD files that are kind of linked together, and we can easily just reference those bigger chunks in if we have declared them in this way. So what you see here is that we are just declaring an entity, and if we have a parameter entity, we have this percent character, and then the name of the entity, and its project. If we use this later on, we refer to its name. And what you see inside the brackets is the content, more or less what it should include. And because it is something that we use as a parameter entity in the DTD itself, it's obviously it's just a declaration of a certain element. And in this case, it also includes information about which child elements it should contain. And what you see here, see underneath, it's just a reference to that element. There's always, if we reference a certain entity, sorry, I was mixing up element and entity, but if we are citing or referencing a particular entity, we always have the same kind of a structure. We use this in case of parameter entity that we only used in the context of DTD. We have this percent character, the name of the entity, and then the semicolon. So this is just a reference, and then it replaces it with the value, what you see there. And as you can see, there's in the document itself, there's no information about, there's no reference to the entity anymore, because it's just something that we like support to like support the writing of the DTD. And this is also a bit simplified example, but this entity content might be also much, much longer and complicated. And there's also some problems, let's say, if you're using some tool like I'm using this Eclipse tool, because it's not meant originally to handle all kinds of XML formats. And it doesn't also understand these different types of entities very well. So actually, what you see here is that we should have like the projects, and then we would have project that goes underneath, and project has products, ID, and price, or one product ID and price. And if we would do this in a Eclipse, that we would write it according to our, you know, the writing conventions, that it should be somehow nicely readable or something. If we are doing this, it actually, as you can see, there are errors directly. It doesn't understand those parameter entities very well, and it doesn't allow any white spaces in here. So this is a very good example that like Eclipse isn't a very, in all cases, very good tool for dealing with XML content. But if we would, for example, put this now to a browser, I'll try to show it. It's this file, parameter entity XML. As you can see, everything works fine. It's just the contents of the document. Again, we don't have the external presentation given for this, but it's the XML document as is. And as you can see there, the projects and the project, product ID, price, everything works fine. So once we have declared that entity, it works as well as if we would have just declared those this element project separately here. I mean, this is just one way to handle it, but in terms of parameter entities, they are just meant to make DTD writing a bit more simple when you have a complex structure. So, for example, some cases you might want to use this in the same element in the same way in a particular, let's say, part of the DTD or in a different document. You could use then just this entity to reference it, like here and there. Okay, that's if you see this percent character popping up here and there and the entity, the percent character tells it that it's just to be used in a DTD and to help writing of a DTD. And that's how the internal parsed entities are. And if we go to a slightly different example, is that in the XML document itself, you might also use something like this parsed entities to just ease up some type of writing. It might be also according to your, let's say, if your organization has very, very strict way of saying, like, specifying your value proposition or whatso else, and you always need to have it in a concise manner, you might just, like, declare that value proposition as an entity, that you just put it, like, in the what the value proposition is, you would just write it in the value of the entity, and then you reference it in your document, and it's always in the same manner or something like this. And what you see down here is that there's a document type author, element author, and then we declare an entity with named JS and with the value Joe Smith. And in the document itself, because it's a general entity, it's to support writing of the XML documents, not just the helping of writing DTDs, we are referencing from the document. So here starts the document, and we have the element author. And we have the similar, as you might remember from last slide, is that we had the percent character, then the name of the entity, and then the semicolon. In terms of general entity, it's we are using this ampersand character from the document to refer to this. And as you might imagine what this produces in your final XML document, I think I even had it the same example here. Yes. So more or less what it does is, it just replaces the what you have in the value of the entity. It just replaces that in your document. It's more or less simple as that. And if you have this kind of a, even if you have text around this, the parser still understands that here inside is the reference to a particular entity. And you might see this used a bit more often maybe than the previous example of the parameter entity. But, and of course, in real life, this might be something a bit more complicated than a person's name. So this might be something according to your, like, corporate, for example, your copyright or something else that you don't have to always write, that you just reference that, give me this entity from your, using this structure, ampersand, name, and then semicolon. Okay, so that's also one type of entity that you might see, and this is the main difference, so that we have something like that is used in the XML document content, and something like here that we only use in the DTD. Percent character, we cannot reference this entity project at all from our XML document, because if it's already declared with the percent character, so it's only to be used in a DTD context. And also the external parameter entities are something that we can use to link DTDs together. And for example, what I also said, that the HTML DTD consists of multiple DTD fragments that are kind of linked together, because in many cases when you are creating a new language, it might get very, very long and tedious, so sometimes you might put it to certain chunks and just kind of link them together. So that's a quite convenient way to use it. But lately, it has happened that there's a big security issue related to external entities. When I was preparing the slides for last year and some of the examples, I was wondering what's wrong, because when I tried to put some of the examples where I have these external entities that I'm referencing something online and something like I'm not given the value directly when I declare it, but I'm just giving an address where to find it. And I was wondering why the browser doesn't show it at all. But there seems to be a very, very big security issue, vulnerability, for example, to Mac, to iOS and OS X. And it's commonly known something as XSE. So it just means that attackers use XML parsers to carry out different types of attacks. And as you might imagine, if we have something like images, videos, that our system doesn't try to even interpret it, we are just linking to it, it's a very, very easy way to, you know, do some malicious intent to it, like do some kind of a very harmful stuff. So that you are, that's why the usage of these external entities that we are deriving something from, that the parser doesn't even try to understand. It's very risky business to use. So, but this is not just a Mac issue nowadays, because the browsers don't even try to like interpret these external entities. So when they see that there's a reference to an external entity, no matter if it's just a kind of a simple named piece of text, it doesn't try to even interpret. It sees that, okay, it's an external entity, skip it. I'll show how it does. So I have here again an XML document similar to the previous one, and I'm declaring an entity named copyright, and I'm giving a system identifier that where to get this this copyright entity's contents, and I'm giving the name of the file, which is in the same folder where it should be. And in the XML document, I have here the element copy, where the copyright text should appear. But as I mentioned, because of the security issue, firstly I show the text that should appear in the document is something like just like this. So it's just a kind of a text for the copyright, and it's in a different file. But I'm linking to that file from my document, and let's try what it shows, or whether it shows anything. So here it is, and it should go here into the copyright. So what it actually does is just, there should be appearing, you know, the copyright text, but the browser that I'm Firefox now using, it just jumps over it. So this is how browsers nowadays deal with this, and as an outcome, many types of products, systems don't function anymore, or at least that the developers have to find different ways of implementing things because they cannot use this anymore. So this is a very, very serious serious issue, and it's just that it's a big security hole in a way, so that the people can use this to do very, very harmful stuff. Okay, but that's for external entities, but I'm still saying that the previous example that I showed, that I'm referencing, for example, the copyright text, is something like parsed external general entity. So it's just named piece of text, something that the parser should understand. It's parsed, it's external, it's given in a different file, and it's general, it's to be used in the contents of the XML document. But as you saw, it doesn't load well, so there's nothing that we can really do about this. We just avoid using this unless for a very, very good reason. The one to really avoid is something where we use non-XML data in our documents. So something like unparsed content, so some like graphics, video, whatsoever. You will save yourself from a lot of damage by avoiding to declare graphics videos as entities that you would reference in your documents, because this is the biggest security hole that there is. So I won't even speak about this later. So if we're using graphics video in our XML documents or some, for example, in our XSL, like assignment that we had, because we are then doing something in the context of HTML. You remember that when we put the HTML and body tag, we are actually playing by the rules of HTML language. And there's different ways there to link different types of information. And that's much, much safer way compared to declaring something as an entity. So this is something to really avoid. And yes, as I said, that many experienced developers say that unparsed entities are a complicated, confusing mistake that should have never been included in XML in the first place. But nonetheless, they are still part of the specification, and you still might sometimes see those in use, but at least if there's some problems and you see that something doesn't work, you know that this is because of the security issues there, and many of the browser systems, environments, they are skipping when they see this kind of external entity reference. They are just jumping over it because of the security issues. And how we refer to general entities, as you might remember from those examples, we have this ampersand and then the name of the entity, and it just replaces this reference with the contents of the entity. And when we are using these parameter entities in the DTD, and only within DTD, we use this percent character. But this is something also that you see maybe a bit more often, that you can also declare just single characters as entities. And sometimes you might be in a need for special characters from different alphabets, weird language that you don't understand or similar, and that your input device doesn't really have at place. You might actually in your XML, in your DTD, declare some a bit more odd characters that are then displayed in the browser. Because as you remember, XML supports more or less this Unicode, and which more or less includes all the natural languages that are out there. So it's no problem to visualize something like in a browser, but sometimes there might be some issues when you are transferring data from a system to another and something might get lost. But if you are declaring these single characters that might be a bit more odd, it's a kind of a safe way then to make sure that the information is displayed as it should be. So, and in XML there are a few kind of a predefined characters like ampersand, then this these arrowheads, however you call, and these quote marks. These are something that you don't have to declare in your DTD, but if you are referencing, if you want to, for example, some Chinese symbol or something similar in your document, you can just refer to the decimal or hexadecimal code point in Unicode. And if you, for some reason, need to do this, I mean, you can just easily... Oh, again, I'm not online. Wait a bit. Yeah, you can very easily find the listing where you don't have to remember, the such code points by heart, but I mean, Unicode hexadecimal table, there it is. You have here, a very, very long list of the code points and what the character is. So if you need to, let's say these are very simple examples, but if you need to have some very odd characters, you can just refer to this code point in here. And how to do that? I quickly prepared one character references document. I just put out lots of examples there, actually. Okay, let's start making sense out of it. This has quite many things already included. So firstly, in our DTD here, we have an entity rhyme1 declared, and the content of that entity, it's the best ever. And if we are looking at these examples that I had, this is something like an internal entity because it's, you know, the value is given directly. It's not pointing to any external file or anything. It's a general entity, you know, because it's something that we use in the reference from the XML document's contents. We don't declare it here with this percent character, because, you know, then it breaks down. Here you see that directly an X appears that we cannot reference it there because it's then to be used in the DTD only. And, you know, it's parsed entity. It's just like piece of text. It's something that the XML processor knows how to interpret. Then we have an element data that just parsed character data. And then we declare an entity quote with the value that you see in here. And then you have the document. And in your XML document, you can just reference those in the same way as to any general entities by using the ampersand and then the name of the entity and then the semicolon. And I actually have here a bit more examples. As you can see, there's an entity called APOS. But you see here that I haven't declared any entity for APOS. This is because some of the entities are already predefined in XML, so I don't need to here declare this entity APOS at all, because it's already there. But I'll show what this kind of would bring to the browser, and then we can look at it a bit more carefully. Is it here? Yes, you can see here. It's just like it just replaces the with the value, the reference with the value, bringing these quote marks there. And the APOS is, you know, it's just the APOS was the quote mark. Yeah, and ampersand is amp, and it's something also that we don't have to. We are then referencing to its with the real name that is given in the specification. We don't have to declare that specifically. But if we go further, we again have just like Philips. So we have here the second quote, and then we have a reference to the Rhyme 1 entity, which value is it's the best ever, you know, and it should be shown there. And again, here you see the APOS quote mark, and then for a second quote mark reference. And this is also something that we don't need to have here, because this quote marks, these are predefined. So if I delete this from here, it's still there. And then, yeah, you still get the same result. So that's how you use those character entity references. So you can just reference to the hexadecimal point, and then you might have whatsoever weird things on your XML document. So that's kind of as simple as that. You sometimes might need it, sometimes you don't. But it's something that you might come across every now and then. Okay, then we go to the second part of the lecture. But are there any questions regarding that? Because you know, I think in the assignments you don't really need to apply these too much, these entities. But was it quite? Do you think it's hard to grasp what the difference is between a parameter and a general entity? So something that you use in DTD to make, you know, avoid complex writing, reference things. Any questions about this? Okay, let's move to the second part. But just remember, you might sometimes, even though there are a lot of problems with these entities and especially the external entities, but at least if you are sometimes a project manager whatsoever in the future, and you see that your developer is struggling with something when playing around, for example, with entities, at least you know that there might be some of the reasons behind might be. Okay, but then about XML use in organizations and in social media. This is more towards the using XML as a data interchange language. So it's something that, you know, machines then use XML for. It's not something that, you know, previously we have been discussing this XSL, like visualizing something on a web browser to a user, but this is now a bit more allowing systems to interact very easily and therefore allowing us as users use our smartphones, all kinds of apps, like get different types of feeds from different types of services very easily. This is what XML allows. But the main thing is that if you are thinking about like what modern web is, so when you are using internet on a daily basis and different types of social media services, these are very, very heavily depending on XML. XML and also some, let's say, related languages. But the kind of a basis what XML has given is has tremendously changed how you know, internet nowadays is. If you remember, I mean, some of you might be this, about the same age as I am, and I made some websites, you know, like back in 2000 or something. And you think about how there wasn't really, you know, any interactive elements to the websites, something like Guestbook or something like that was the kind of the farthest as you gone, but how it's so tremendously changed that nowadays you aren't relying too much on some static information that you see on a web browser, but you can very easily link different types of sources together and like really modify what you want to be displayed to as a user, but also as a, you know, like a provider of some blog or whatsoever. You can very easily then just like integrate different things together, and this is very much relying on XML and something that could be called as Web 2.0 technologies and standards, and where the XML is kind of at the building block, the basic, the very core. But if we think about XML usage, I mean, all of this using XML for all kinds of transformations and like declaring our documents, giving them proper structure and grammar, that's all very, very good. But I mean, the very core purpose of XML is to allow applications and services to interact with each other in a very easy and standardized way. And if we are thinking about any types of, let's say, something that we might understand as social media services, like XML is, it allows us to, if we think about using, let's say, Facebook or Twitter or similar, or if we are tagging like photos and then very seamlessly browsing through them, these are based on only a few selected XML-based languages that are kind of making it possible. But if we think about this variety of services, it connects to all of these very very well. From XML, there are all kinds of languages derived. As you remember, it's just a meta language, and some of the most like influential are displayed on this page. So if we think something like this Ajax, it's something like that allows dynamic web applications, kind of that ease our lives as users. So it's just something that the client and server can communicate very easily and freely with each other. And if we just look at this website that kind of lists the use cases where what more or less Ajax allows us to do is, there's something like from logging forms, but let's say we start from Google, all of these like autocomplete functions that it more or less what you're typing it already predicts and displays this recommendation to you. These are based on Ajax, but all kinds of voting rating functionalities. The Twitter feeds that are kind of a constantly updating or in Facebook are based on Ajax. So something that you don't have to always just refresh your page all the time, but it's something very seamless, like discussion between the client and server side. But all kinds of, you know, when you're filling some web forms and if you're doing some errors there, it more or less validates this on the fly. So if there are like some errors, it kind of displays something directly if there's something wrong. But in terms of chat rooms, instant messaging, from different types of annotation tools, widgets, light boxes, and so on, Ajax is very, very, very frequently used, or one of the ones that are very frequently used. So it's one of the, let's say, major innovations that are coming from XML. Something that you might be very well familiar is some like this RSS, so syndication between applications. So more or less you can aggregate in your browser on your mobile some news that you only want to be exposed to. So it just shows selected data that you have specified. Or Atom is very similar, like language that is derived from XML. But also there are like multiple other types, and especially in this kind of a what happens like behind the user's eyes, something that happens in the back end, the main magic kind of happens there. And this SOAP and VSDL will be a bit more discussed in the next lecture, and how it's done in terms of like in enterprises. So Ville is gonna discuss that in the guest lecture next time. But these are some of the very, very core principles or building blocks that have made modern web what it is now, and allows us to do multiple types of things with the devices that we have. I wanted to show a couple of examples, like from one project that we were leading with Philip a couple of years ago. It was an EU project called Open Scout. I think Philip mentioned something about that, but it was just to provide this one place, one portal online where, let's say, business schools or like managers in something like in HR might come and find different types of case studies and learning materials that are openly available for them to use. So this it really ties into this. You might have heard this open education phenomena that we are giving some like materials like as Creative Commons license, so that when you are seeing some material as a teacher or something, you know that it's something that I can then reuse in my own slides, that I'm not violating any copyrights or anything. So there wasn't any kind of a place where you could find like management related content online in a open way. So this Open Scout portal was something that we created in one international project. And actually, if we're thinking about where altogether XML somehow plays in together, it's kind of a funny that nothing in this portal kind of a functions without the existence of XML. We discussed that with a couple of developers from the project, and coming really to understand how much we are kind of depending on the XML specification here. So first of all, this kind of a platform allows you to find learning materials that might be somehow tagged with different types of information. Like if we want to find something on organizational behavior in different languages, we can use different types of filters. And more or less what you see underneath then always is some list of learning materials that kind of fulfill this criteria. And all of these learning materials, what we have here in the portal is just we are collecting metadata about materials that are scattered, out there in the world. We aren't collecting, we aren't downloading all the materials from, some databases of some business schools around the world. We are just linking to them. But we need there to have a standardized way to declare the metadata for these learning materials. And that's where it gets complicated, because, we have some standards out there already to declare metadata for learning materials. I'll have one slide about that. But in many cases, universities, different types of like private sector, they don't necessarily use these standards. They have their own, own DTDs, something else defined where they kind of say what the learning materials are and what the metadata is. And we need to have a consistent way of finding these resources out there and making those metadata harmonized. So that was a huge, huge challenge, which also kind of calls for this kind of a more universal standards and norms that like different institutions follow. Because if we have something declared in a common way, there's no problem for us to reference to it anywhere, like from our own devices. But if we don't have this structure, it's very, very hard to get this all of things compiled in one place. But I'll show that a bit more in the slides still. But later in the lecture. But also, if we think about any kinds of wikis and blogs and the way how you can modify them very easily, I mean that you can enrich and extend their functionalities, you know, from some if you are managing the properties of your own blog or something, you can very easily just add some like interactive elements whatsoever there, and these are made possible with the XML-based languages that allow the discussion between these new components that you're integrating. But the thing to remember is that this is something that's more or less hidden from you as a user, but you still are so much depending on XML. It's abstract, but it's more or less everywhere. If we think about like internet as it is nowadays, and for utilization of XML, we can make some kind of a, you know, categorization of what XML could be used for. We firstly can say that it's as a format for information assets as documents. So our XML documents contain information about it can be a calendar, it can be something like TV schedule, it can be, you know, whatever in your assignments. But it also could be something that we want to show online to a bunch of users, display in our organization, for example, between different units in the organization to just store information about the employees and use that for our purpose. So XML, okay, it's very good for that. But where it's used as metadata, it's becoming much more, let's say, relevant because it allows us to do so many things. I mean, to retrieve content and just give our kind of a preferred ways of what we want to be exposed to, and more or less the machines behind allow us to be exposed to this. And metadata is one of the main assets here. In this course, we don't discuss databases in specific, but it can be also seen as a database format. But most of the major databases, they support XML in general, but this is not really the focus of this course. And in addition to this, the format for data in the exchange, it's the what, let's say, the remainder of the lectures will mainly be discussing about. And if you are to become like a developer in the future or project manager or something similar in IT projects, I think this is something that you have to be rather aware of. You don't necessarily have to know, you know, I mean, there are different types of language for different purposes. You don't have to be an expert in all of these, but knowing some of the basics behind is surely helpful. I just want to show you, like, World Wide Web Consortium, they have kind of a collect this type of place where you can browse through different types of languages that are derived from XML, and you know the list is just increasing all the time. I mean the XML essentials, I mean they are what we have been more or less discussing so far, but the efficient interchange, the dividing like these constraints and schemas, this is an area where there has been a lot of work in the last few years. And as we have been saying, that the DTD is very, very limited, and it doesn't really usually work if you have a complex organizational structures, complex systems. You usually need more, also a bit more powerful tool around that. And XML schema is one of those ones. What also we used in this OpenScout project. But there are all kinds of extensions for security, for transforming, for doing different sort of queries, and so on. I mean, the list goes on, but this is being extended all the time. And that's more or less the beauty behind. If we think about XML as a document format, the examples, more or less, we know already the web publishing from the assignment that we have been working on with the XSL, but also like for learning materials, for scholarly text, for technical documentation in factories, but also in public sector, it's very widely used. But also publishing industries is also very much relying on XML as a document format. And if we think about XML as a document format, then we are applying this kind of a structured documents in our organization, no matter if it's private or public. We are defining the documents with DTD or schema or something similar. But and this is also very, very complicated and somehow overlooked part. People many times think that, okay, when we just define, you know, a schema for our organization, that then all the documents kind of correspond to. It's actually a very, very tedious thing that if you do not do it well, let's say over time, it's something that might break down like big parts of the workflows in organizations and also disrupt the work of many workers. Sir. So this is something that cannot be really overemphasized. And I think anyone who has worked with any kinds of this schema planning, knows this rather well, because you have to more or less, if you have some like let's say user layer, you really need to understand their requirements, their preferences of using what they are needing. But I mean, this is it goes on from different types of organization structures, and that you need to kind of map very, very well together. So that's a complicated area. And of course, you can use different types of queries to collect information from your XML documents and give it the external presentation. So that's more or less the basics about XML as a document format. And the required efforts really depend on the complexity of the cases. If we think about some examples, you know, XHTML for web publishing is one of the most common for XML as a document format, and you might have very, let's say, beautiful pages also in this one. So you have the links to the slide, so if you want to have a look and also look at some of the source code and how it's similar to XML, you might want to do that. But there are also some, let's say, industry-related standards that have been created, let's say, for technical documentation for factories, but also for the news industry. And this is also what I just told earlier, that if we don't have some kind of a common way of defining, constraining something, it's very, very hard then to make use of it in a wider scale. So let's just say if lots of the different organizations in the news industry are worldwide, like using similar types of standards, for example, applying this NITF, it's much easier than for us to like retrieve any kind of a content that they might have or they have published out there. And this is also very powerful for, you know, all any kind of a search engines whatsoever, then we can very easily find the content as fast as possible. But this is one good, a bit bigger, you know, initiative, a standard based on XML that helps a particular industry. And in this case, it's news industry. So some newspapers, New York Times, news agencies, and so on, utilize this type of standards. Then we go to the XML as a metadata format, and you know, metadata is just information about data and some parts of it. So in terms of those learning materials that we have in Open Scout, it's just, you know, something about what kind of educational level it is, who's the author, which university or something has been using it, and so on. It's just to like useful information that we might be able to make benefit of at some point in time. We also, like, the basic thing is that if we collect very versatile types of metadata, we don't always have to use all of that in at once. But let's say some other, like, unit, some other organization might make use of something that we haven't been actually thinking of ourselves when we have created these metadata files. And metadata doesn't always need to be something that we fill manually. This is a kind of a misconception that if we have big parts of learning materials whatsoever that we like manually write one-on-one, like all the very, very long pieces of text that like describing what it is, how it's been used. But sometimes, you know, metadata can be also like done automatically based on how users use these materials, where they use it, how often, and so on. It might be that based on that, we are generating some metadata that we can then make use of. So the examples of metadata, I go directly to this learning object metadata that we kind of had to struggle with in this Open Scout project. So it's something like again an international, you know, XML-based language to kind of define metadata for learning materials. That's more or less as simple as that. So kind of like common information about who's the author, title, publisher, publishing date, and so on. And the thing is that, okay, this is very, very handful in a way, useful in a way, but in Open Scout we came to understand that we have a bit more requirements. We need to have some other type of information about the learning materials. So for example, where they have been used. Some teachers were really asking, let's say, on what kind of theories or what kind of pedagogical strategies they relate to or whatsoever, what kind of a didactical approaches have been used around those, you know, as teachers, some might need that. But this learning object metadata, it didn't even have any elements that where we can specify this type of information. So we needed to extend that in Open Scout, and that proved out to be a quite complicated effort. So we firstly identified that, okay, this standard learning object metadata is not sufficient for our project. Teachers want something more. And if we just present, you know, on a web portal some information with that very basic information, they said that they won't use it because they are missing out some vital information. So we needed to extend this learning object metadata with our own, you know, our own schema. We didn't use DTD because DTD is too restricted in this way, and this we used XML schema to kind of define our constraints and the grammar, the syntax for our language. So we extended the with additional elements like teaching and learning context, so where they have been used, those materials in which kind of setting. Any kinds of issues about the pedagogical approach, didactics, and so on. So we actually ended up combining this learning object metadata schema with the Open Scout schema, which is, it was a quite huge issue. And then what we have is that we have the XML files attached. You know, this is kind of the DTD in the top. It's the grammar, the syntax. And then we have XML files, which is the actual metadata files about the learning materials. So if we have some slide sets like what I have right here, in the XML files we just specify what kind of a metadata I have here. You know, it might be that, okay, I've been giving a course in University of Jyväskylä in this and that year, and it's been used for this purpose, so you might want to use it like this and that in the future for other teachers to make sense of. So that's more or less the differentiation to what we have been discussing so far. We used LOM schema to define the grammar, the syntax. Then we have XML files that only is the metadata. You know, as we said, the actual materials, if it's some case studies in PDF or like websites that include some Open University courses that you can browse through in Moodle, or if it's videos or PowerPoints whatsoever, those are just links from the metadata files. Just link pointing out somewhere else. So the actual XML files are just metadata. But this was very, very complicated setting because this metadata about materials, as I said, it wasn't in a unified way, like in different databases around there. I mean, some educational what is called repository, so more or less a database for educational materials, they might use this LOM, but they might also use something else, or they might have created something that they saw beneficial in the first place. And as you might think that if there's, let's say, a teacher in a business school and is looking here for some particular learning material that he has used before and he expects to find here, and if our excuse is a kind of a provider of this type of portal is saying that okay, we couldn't collect that information because they don't follow the same schema as we are using. That's not a really a good excuse. So we had to do a very, very hard work to somehow map between all of the existing kind of standards that are out there, languages for like declaring these learning materials and making it unified, and what we kind of retrieve and how we convert, how we transform the ones that are in the wrong format to this right format. It was something that we thought that we need only a few weeks or a couple of months, but we actually ended up doing that like 3 years throughout the project. I mean, even though we could do some development around it, but that was critical because you need to understand what the user needs and requirements are, and if you aren't following them, then you are in problem. But that kind of showcases the reality that, okay, it's great, there are international standards whatsoever, the schema files that we can follow, but it's very often that they don't follow the same style. Okay, I'll quickly show you how this schema looks like. Okay, if I put it to browser, you know, it, as usually, it tries to interpret it. It just takes away the tags. Let's see if the if I copy paste this too. Okay, not better. I'll view page source. Then I get to see what the. So XML schema, if you think about how DTD looks like, you know, there's all very, you have the declaration at the start, then you specify the element structures, the constraints for your elements, attributes, and so on. This is more or less very much the same thing, but what you also see here is that the we are using these namespaces constantly, I mean throughout, you know, namespaces just to avoid these name collisions, because we might, these metadata files, let's say if we are declaring metadata for thousands of learning materials and they are somehow connected to one master file in some way, it's very obvious that we are we have some overlaps. We might be using the same element name, so we have to differentiate between them. And in this XML schema, they have a very particular way of, you know, declaring what the namespaces are, just that, okay, now we are using a namespace from the XML schema itself, and then where to find it, and then we are also here declaring our own namespace, because, you know, as I said, we need to extend. We couldn't use the learning object metadata as is, but we needed to extend it. So we are also referencing to this our own kind of a namespace. And the XML doc, or this schema document that kind of corresponds to DTD is, you know, it's nothing more like bigger than that. It's just, it makes it a bit more complicated looking that you always have to have this reference to what namespace this belongs to. You know, this belongs to the LOM namespace, the element string, and then some tags around it, like attributes around it, and so on. So it's just to like declare, you know, here's, it seems that there are in German some materials related to information security. So it's just cool, like displays like metadata for these materials, where they can be found and in which format they are. There's, you know, it goes on and on. And sometimes you see in the schema this Open Scout, so that kind of refers to our own schema, our own namespace. So we are kind of saying that, okay, these things bring me from the universal standard of LOM, and these specific additions, like about the pedagogical style whatsoever, give me these elements from the Open Scout namespace, or they belong to the Open Scout namespace. So schema is it's something like this, but the beauty behind this is that it's a bit more, it can be used in a bit more complicated settings than DTD. But that's more or less how it is. And in Open Scout portal, if we are referring to a certain, okay, this is one example of those learning materials. It just points out some tietoturva materials, and it has some metadata around it that comes from, you know, this the according XML documents that describe the learning material metadata. So it's something that the user teacher might then make use of. And then, you know, there's a link to the wherever the material is. And but yeah, that's one of the examples from OpenScout that we kind of had to deal with. Is any one of you working with XML schema? We usually had maybe one or two from like working in some organization, and they are here just to hear a bit more or like find out if there are different types of ways for handling some parts of information. But okay, this time maybe someone viewing from home then might have this. Okay, why to use metadata? Okay, mainly information retrieval. You know, as in this OpenScout portal, it allows us to find information, extract something from that. That's what we don't want to describe data just for describing data. I mean, that doesn't help anyone. But if it allows us to do something, you know, to maintain access, to get content as fast as possible, and support information exchange through, you know, various systems and applications out there, I think that's the beauty of it. As many of these materials that you saw there, they might be in the database, lying on the databases of a, let's say, a university in France or something, and the university staff in France doesn't have any idea that they have these learning materials lying on their database, but we are just gathering it in one place and making it available for someone else who might make use of it if this university isn't. So I think that's the beauty of having very rich type of metadata. Okay, and then XML as a data exchange format. I mean, when we have different types of systems, software, applications, I mean, it's obvious that when we are pressing any button in our mobile phone, connecting to any kind of app, something really is happening behind. And this is where XML comes and kind of helps in global, in local settings, and so on. And what is actually being interchanged when you do something in this OpenScout portal, when you like add a tag or whatsoever, it actually, what happens behind is that XML documents are being sent around in the back end as well. But between applications, humans don't see it. It's something that happens instantly. It's something like, this user added this tag, add it to the database, show it to the user, or something like this. It's very, very seamless and fast communication that happens. But Ville is going to discuss more about this, so I won't spend too much time on this during this lecture. But the most common examples of XML as a data exchange format is that this integration of systems by a common user interface. So as you can see, this OpenScout portal that we had, it actually takes, we didn't develop most of the, when you have those menu tabs whatsoever, all kinds of tools, services that you have there in place, we didn't develop most of these. It just allows us to very easily connect them together and show them to a user, and it looks like, you know, one big thing, one common user interface, so that we can integrate those services in a portal. But in many cases, this data exchange is something that not just within an organization, but it's something that might happen in when different businesses do cooperation together or something else. It's something that goes beyond the organizational boundaries as well. Okay, this is actually the example of what I said, that in if you are adding, let's say, a tag to a particular learning material, so something like, okay, I see that this relates to social computing, I just add there the tag name, and what it actually just sends around is that what happens in the background is that there's a service call sent, which just says that, okay, this is the name of the tag, social computing, user ID, blah, 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 whatever my user ID, this guy sent it, then which learning material, learning object it refers to, and that's it. And then there's a reply, something if it worked or not. And this is something that happens in an instant. So these kind of service calls are something that for different purposes happen like all the time. And this SOAP language, which is kind of the XML documents for data in the exchange that are sent around. And you can think about SOAP as the XML documents that are sent around, and then VSDL is kind of the DTD of SOAP. It just says, gives you the kind of the constraints and the grammar. But again, that's something for next lecture. But this is something that happens like all the time in when you are using your devices, when you're browsing anywhere online. There are all kinds of service calls whatsoever sent around. Very fast data interchange that kind of what is shown to you as a kind of a very seamless user experience. So we are very much making use of this in OpenScout, but also in many other projects. But again, this is only one option that developers might take. You know, the advances in web publishing and also in web development, is they are progressing so fast that there are all kinds of alternative ways of handling things. But this is one of them. And what we are also making use of in this OpenScout is this Ajax. So when you had this web browser here, when you have the search engine and you are being constantly like exposed to when you click something that you are things are changing. So this is something that happens within the kind of the client and the server continuously. Whatever you do here is that it kind of changes what you are getting. Again, based on XML, but again, not part of this course, but I hope you get to experiment a bit during your studies and in your work life with some of these languages. Hey, as a kind of a final thing, I would like to just maybe raise your thinking a bit for the last part of the lecture as a kind of an interaction point, that giving you a kind of a case and a problem that you might think about. Okay, there's a newspaper making a decision to digitalize their news contents for archiving purposes, but also to deliver news to readers throughout various channels, like digital version online, through mobile devices, and so on. So what I want you to think, let's say with your discussing groups, or if you are sitting far from them, just think for yourself, in which ways XML and specific languages that are derived from XML could be a solution in this case. So, if you would be working in this company and you would be given this task, where would you kind of start? What would you what you have heard today, but also during this course, in which ways you could use XML? Just think about it for a minute or two, and then let's briefly look at what the options could be. So, you're allowed to discuss. Thank you.
Do you still need a minute, or are you discussing weather or what to do in the evening? Or anyone needs a minute, or should we just go through? I heard mennään täällä, so it's good. Any solutions where you don't need to even if you want to just specify or like discuss on this multi-channel publishing whatsoever, what kind of things you came up with? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Website design. Did anyone else think anything else than the website design? Any other examples or something specific about the website or like this multi-channel publishing? Yeah. Yeah, I think the especially that whatever you are doing for like setting the kind of the grammar rules for your news content, I think that's the very very critical. So we can just, unless you have some more examples, we could maybe look at some of the potentials that you might have. But those were very good points. So. Okay, first of all, what one good to? Okay, I mean, you might come up with a very different solution yourself, but I mean, what could be done is that if we have, you know, something industry specific that is already out there. I mean, this as a developer, as an organization, I would really firstly investigate like to which extent this can be a solution for the problem in our organization or what the potentials are. So if there's some industry-specific language, let's say, like in this case, this news industry text format, it would be very, very sense-making to look that, okay, then we have a standard way already for declaring the article's content structure and the types of metadata that the organization might utilize. And because, you know, it's quite widely used, so it's already quite widely developed. So this is maybe something that could be thought about, is that is it sense-making to create your own language, your own language for like describing news content in your organization? I mean, if you want to have a particular, you know, competitive advantage or something above some others, and you think that this your own schema or something might really be the solution to this, I mean, why not invest, you know, quite big amount of euros or dollars to creating your own kind of a language for describing your news content? But at least it's then you have the disadvantage that it's very unlikely that you would have any exchange between existing platforms. So if you are collaborating or you are, let's say, unifying with your business with another like company in the industry, and you need to exchange some information, and they are applying, let's say, an industry specific one, and you have chosen against that, you will have a problem then, of course, if some platforms services need to interact in some way. So this is surely some disadvantage that should be discussed or thought about. And making sure that all the key workers in the writing publishing process use the same template structures that the schema defines, and making sure that you understand how these people work, that you can kind of create kind of a schema or something that corresponds to the what you want to get out of it. I mean, that you don't just create something, let's say, in 5-10 minutes and then find out that it doesn't really help in the real life setting if some editor is trying to do something or retrieving particular type of information that you haven't even considered for your DTD or schema, then you might have a very, very big problem and might cost big amounts of euros if you have already implemented something around it, and then if you make some changes in your schema and it can have some very severe implications on your implementation. So this is very, very crucial step. which should be done carefully. But of course, you can extend some of the existing ones like we did within OpenScout. And you might also define separate schemas for different types of content types. So if you have some news articles, you might have something else like in your digital version. So something you might have from sports to TV, weather, whatsoever. So you might also have different schemas that describe different types of content that you have in your newspaper. The website that you also mentioned as an example, that and the digital online version, that's of course XML could help there. And we have been discussing this in the lecture already, that XSL is something that you might want to use. And XSL is again only one of the examples. But when you are using XSL, the beauty of it is that you can extract only some the information you want from the XML documents. You don't have to expose everything you have stored in, let's say, when you describe your news content, that you have to expose all of that online. You can just, with XSL, as you might remember, you can just take bits and pieces, give them an external presentation, and show it to the reader. So that's something that XML could do. Again, so that's one of the options, but not the only one. The authors also could somehow submit in an online system, which is directly connected to the editorial process. And you could use some different types of forms that where you kind of that follows the schema already, so that you don't have to, journalist whatsoever, you don't have to know XML. You aren't being exposed to anything related to XML. You have a form, or you have another, like where you just write in your content, and it kind of transferred it to an XML document, and somebody else has done the thinking for what the schema should be like, and that it corresponds to these forms that the journalist is filling. You might also define the style sheet for different types of devices and the transformations of content with XSLT for the different types of devices separately, which is, of course, one option. The website could apply this XHTML or CSS or XSL using this Ajax for fast response between the client and server. And SOAP, VSDL, similar protocols to bridge different services and applications together. And the readers themselves, they could just be given this RSS like functionality to kind of just extract the information that they want from the news. So that's one option. But one thing would be the critical thing to discuss or think about is to separate the metadata from the news articles themselves. So if you have a long piece of text like about a particular person or organization whatsoever, that you also have very rich information, metadata about this, where it's been taking place and what's there in the background, so that you could also use that for like this fast information retrieval. And if some person is writing one keyword there online or something, you are then exposing directly this news content that match these tags that are given that correspond to the metadata that you have for this news content. So that's a very, very important thing to think about. So that's why this indexing retrieval, so that any types of queries could be done very easily to the content, so that no matter where these queries come from, is it something that the user does or in your organization separately, that's very critical. Various information about the articles, the context, place, journalist could be presented, as additional information in the website, and you could use this XSL transformations for doing this, or just for archiving purposes, and even for organizational, tracking performance-related issues or something. If management wants to check how active certain journalists have been and how much they have been publishing whatsoever, and they could just, from the data that is generated in an XML format, they could just, use it for tracking purposes within the organization. And further possibilities, the organization could tie the solutions to their existing infrastructure or even rebuild something towards more transparent and seamless solution, because this is the one of the key issues. Is it, no matter what you are developing, you are always restricted kind of to the environment around you. And so if your organization isn't equipped for something very modern whatsoever, you have to take this into account. So this is kind of for the further possibilities, but I think this would be more or less the first thing to think about. What's the kind of a starting point in your organization? What can you do? And what is also sense-making to do? And budget, money-wise, what you can do. That you don't start a massive project. You know, you are being in the charge of a project management, and some they are giving, like, asking from you the budget or something for doing something like this, and you're just estimating, yeah, give me 10,000 euros and I'll do it. And then in the end, that doesn't anyway correspond to the reality, and you aren't taking into account the infrastructures that you have and the actual work effort that is related to this, and how many different types of people need to be involved in developing something like this. That's something, of course, to consider. And depending on the collaborators or the business units, further integration then could be done based on XML. So some of these are like what you might think about. But also, I might say also something about the exam already, that we usually have had some kind of a question like this, that you have a kind of some problem or something, and you need to kind of just elaborate on how XML could support this. So try to think about this example, but also think about if you already have some connections to a particular organization, public, private, whatsoever sector, think about like what XML could do there or what they are already using, because I think that kind of a thinking might be very, very good way to prepare yourself also for the exam. I'm not saying that we will have that, but it's quite likely. And just as a kind of a, we're already over time, so two last slides is something about the challenges of XML, that there's constant changes in languages, applications, and parallel competing standardization activities that makes it very, very hard for, you know, for the developers themselves to think about what do I apply from all of these jungles of applications, environments around me, what is the best suitable for me. That's a complicated issue. And, you know, there are some standards that are being kind of removed at some points, and some, you know, the security threats appearing that kind of might jeopardize your whole company, your whole business, because you have been accustomed to do something, and now there's a big loophole or something that kind of destroys your work so far. So, I mean, these are, of course, challenging issues around it. And this XML standardization or schema design for organization is a very very complicated and a time-consuming task. Agreeing on structures and so on is quite hard. And the benefits that XML brings, many very often are not shown to the people who do the actual work around, you know, XML. They only see, you know, that they are filling out some form or something else, but you know what happens in the background. It might be that they realize that it's easier to do my job or something like this, but they don't know what enables it. It might be that the developer who says, yes, I've done it, but the office workers who or some others, they might not know at all that they are applying or using XML. So this is, I think, the big responsibility of any kind of a developer or person who works for document management or so. Okay, and setting for the borders for the course, bear with me for 1 minute. So we will have still next week, I mean, there's now two visiting lectures this Thursday, next Tuesday. Be there, because I mean, both of those will be quite interesting, practical, and next week, especially Tuesday, Joni Kettunen is coming from Digia, because he has a very, very long history in all different types of private public sector projects. So I think he might be able to give you some very, very detailed hints how, to which extent you should, you know XML in general when you enter work life, because he has seen kind of all kinds of angles from, you know, management position, from being a developer and so on. So I think this is, and you know, they might be also hiring. You never know. So it's good to be there where companies are present. So setting borders for the course. Remember that the exam, what you really need to know from get out from this course is those basics, those logical structure, the building blocks of XML, and then the how you might the kind of also the theoretical knowledge how you might apply XML in different types of settings. But you don't need to master XML schema. You don't need to master XSL, these namespaces and other extensions, because you know the extensions, they are constantly coming up. You cannot be master all of these. I mean, no person does. You always have a kind of a selected things that you are kind of exceeding or working with. But try to showcase that you mastered basics around XML, the well-formed validity, writing the basic XML document, understanding the DTD, because this is also something that we might have in a, you know, in an exam that you might have to interpret a document, or you might have to write a simple XML document. So just think about this. We don't make it too tedious, but it's very obvious to see that if you have actually done the assignments yourself. So please make sure that you at least understand what you have written in the assignments that you have returned, that you haven't been just a side stander, because then it might be a challenge for you, the exam that usually, at least last year, was seen pretty straightforward for the students. Okay, last two things. Those two visiting lectures upcoming, be there, have fun, ask lots of questions, and next week on Thursday is the returning of the last assignment. Please start it already this week, because it's, you know, it's a bit more tedious, because you have to know some things around XML as well. So yeah, I think this concludes the lecture. So this Thursday we'll continue with Ville Seppänen. So thanks for coming.